Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, the top story today concerns the double whammy that hit the Northeast, not just Hurricane Sandy, but now a nor'easter, which has devastated communities that already had no power. Believe it or not, some homes have had no power for almost 2 weeks. Almost 2 weeks. Some of my friends, in fact, have actually left the Northeast entirely because there's been no power for 2 weeks. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? Well, some people say go nuclear. The whole situation is made worse by global warming, some people say, and therefore the solution is to go nuclear, because nuclear does not create carbon dioxide. Well, with us today, our special guest is Michael Marriott, and he's the director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., one of the leading clearinghouses for information concerning nuclear energy. And he's going to talk to us about Fukushima. The accident, what happened, its aftermath, and what does it mean for the United States of America? Germany, Switzerland, other European countries are going anti-nuclear. They've said, we've had it. Japan is tottering at the point of eliminating nuclear power plants. But America is going in the opposite direction. President Barack Obama, who was just recently elected, and I should say congratulations to President Obama, well, his program is to go nuclear. And the question is that really the solution to the global warming problem? And what's going to hit the Northeast as we continue to have monster hurricanes ravage the area? Well, the other question that we're going to investigate today is, well, what are you going to do about it? We just can't sit back because the economy will be destroyed, lives will be disrupted, people will die as a consequence of these monster hurricanes. So first of all, we have to know what the relation is with global warming, and then what are we going to do about it? First of all, there's no smoking gun. You can't say, aha, this was caused by global warming, because global warming is an average effect. It averages over years to decades. And you have to realize, however, that the energy of a monster storm comes from warm water, specifically the warm water of the Gulf of Mexico. That's the energy which drives these monster storms. And this year, it was hotter than normal in many places near the Gulf. In fact, up to 5 degrees warmer, which energized hurricanes as they passed through the Gulf of Mexico. Not to mention the fact that this time the Gulf Stream collided with a warm air mass to create this monster hybrid storm called Sandy. And some people think that even the jet stream from the Arctic is influenced by global warming because the polar ice caps are thinning. Glaciers are receding, and the ice cap itself is 50% thinner than it was 50 years ago. Well, if the jet stream is disrupted and it collides with warmer air from the Gulf of Mexico, that's a prescription for monster hurricanes. And then the question is, well, what are we going to do about it? Long-term and short-term solutions. The long-term solution is we have to grab the bull by the horns. We have to do something about global warming. But let's talk about short-term fixes. Well, some people say we should go for a soft path. Other people say we should go for a hard path. So let's differentiate between the soft path and the hard path. The soft path says, why don't we make small, environmentally friendly changes, which are not going to eliminate the problem, but simply make the problem less aggravating and less damaging. For example, some of the hospitals in New York City had to be evacuated, and these are people in intensive care units. Mothers with newborn babies had to be evacuated in the middle of a hurricane. Why? Because people put their backup generators in the basement, just like at Fukushima. No, that's not the way to go. In case of a hurricane or a tsunami, the worst place you want to put your backup generators is in the basement because they're going to get wiped out, and that's exactly what happened in New York City. So simple things can be done, like, for example, backup power and generators. One of the main problems facing people in the Northeast is lack of power due to the fact that the power plant went down or a tree went over the wire. Well, people should have more generators. They should have more backup facilities. Power plants have to be reinforced, and power companies have to cut down some of the trees which overhang right over the power lines. Also, some environmentalists say, why not abandon some areas? Some areas are going to be engulfed by the ocean no matter what you do. So even if you try to reclaim some beachfront property, eventually Mother Nature will take its toll and it will go back to the sea. So some people say, why not be flexible? Flexible about exactly where we should put beach house property next to the oceans, given the fact that in some areas, well, it's a goner. Almost nothing you can do can prevent the oceans from reclaiming this land. So there's a lot of things we can do in the soft path that people have talked about. But there's also the hard path, and that is storm surge barriers, sea walls, levees, and sea gates. Well, there's a case to be made there, too. Other cities have done it. Take a look at London, St. Petersburg, Russia, Tokyo, as well as the Netherlands, and even Stamford, Connecticut. There are cities which have thrown up their hands and said, we've had it. We're not going to be deluged by the winds and the storms and the hurricanes anymore. We're going to build barriers. And the Dutch, of course, have led the way. It turns out these storm surges, well, they actually work. However, they are expensive. One for New York, for example, would cost about $10 billion. The American Society of Civil Engineers did a study, in fact, of New York Harbor. You would have to have at least one gigantic storm surge barrier about 5 miles across. That alone would cost about $6 billion. But other people say, well, New York lags at the tail. Other nations and other cities have already taken the initiative. They've already built these barriers, and they are, relatively speaking, invulnerable to these storm surges. So why not New York City and other cities around the United States? Well, there are drawbacks that we should point out. First of all, if you have a gigantic storm surge barrier, that means that a wave comes in and bounces right off. Bounces off with tremendous kinetic energy because the energy is not dissipated anymore. And that energy has to go someplace. And oftentimes, it disrupts the neighboring areas. And so the neighboring areas next to the storm surge barrier actually have about a 20% increase in kinetic energy hitting their shores, creating more beach erosion. And what about beachfront property? New Jersey alone has over 100 miles of beachfront property. You can't possibly put a storm surge barrier there. Well, some people say that's where sand replenishment comes in. Now, let's be honest. These are nothing but technical fixes. In some sense, they are temporary because the oceans are rising in sea level at the rate of about a foot per century. With global warming, it's going to even accelerate that. So inevitably, many of these areas will be reclaimed by the sea. That's inevitable. But in the meantime, some people are saying, but the economy, the livelihood of millions of people depends upon tourism, depends upon this beachfront property and these boardwalks. So it's like maintenance. You have to pay the piper. You have to bite the bullet and, yet, like insurance, pay the premiums. So some people say sand replenishment is the way to go. They point to Miami Beach. It turns out that South Beach, Florida, at one point was decaying. But the city fathers there said that we have to bite the bullet. We have to allocate tens of millions of dollars to replenish the sands of Miami Beach. And bingo, it worked. South Beach is actually flourishing right now. However, as we said before, it is a temporary fix. No one expects it to last forever. But at least in the short term, if you're willing to pay the price of hauling tons and tons of sand from other areas, then it might work. But then you ask the question, is this really a permanent solution? I mean, in some sense, we're sitting on beaches that have been there for thousands of years. How come now? How come now we seem to be losing so much beachfront property? Well, there's a reason. It's complex, but it has to do with where sand comes from. If you think about it, the oceans always reclaim sand. So the beaches, in some sense, are always eroding. So why do we have a steady state? Why do some beaches last for thousands of years? Because there's a new supply of sand coming in. And where does this new supply of sand come from? It comes from inland, from lake sediments. But you see, in America, we dam everything. We dam this river, we dam that river. It's almost like a national pastime putting dams on rivers. Well, that may be good for certain cities, but downstream, it means less sediment. And over decades, it means that beaches are not being replenished. That means that the oceans naturally reclaim the sand, but the sand is replenished because of the fact that we have lake sediments feeding into the beaches. But because of overdevelopment, because everybody wants to have their own dam, it means there's less lake sediment going into the beaches, so the beaches are eroding. And as we mentioned before, sea levels are rising. Sea levels are rising for several reasons, not just the melting of ice, but mainly the expansion of water when it's hot. Hot things tend to expand. Water expands when it gets warmer, and because the oceans are heating up, it means water is expanding, and that's causing sea level rise, and that, of course, is tied to global warming. So there's no silver bullet. Nobody has a simple answer to this problem. What are we going to do with these monster hurricanes? But there is a long-term solution. The long-term solution is to do something about global warming. Because it's global warming, we think, that is energizing these monster hurricanes, and we could see them in the future. Have you noticed that we've been having these 100-year floods, 100-year droughts, 100-year forest fires? Have you ever noticed the wacky weather we've been having? And again, there's no smoking gun. You can't point to global warming and say, aha, that's what caused the forest fires of Texas. That's why the Mississippi River has been overflowing. It's global warming. No, you can't say that. But what you can say is that all the arrows point in the same direction. Every single arrow is pointing up. The glaciers of the world are receding. Every major glacier is receding on the planet Earth. The polar ice caps are thinning, 50% thinning of the ice caps in the last 50 years. The seasons are changing. Summers are getting longer. Winters are getting shorter. Tropical diseases are spreading north, not south. As the temperature rises, tropical diseases can spread the area where they lay eggs, and that means that diseases and insects are spreading north. Not to mention the wacky weather, because what does global warming really mean? It doesn't mean uniform warming. Global warming is a misnomer. It should actually be called the weather on steroids. In other words, global swings. When you energize the planet Earth and you have more energy because you trap energy with carbon dioxide, it means there's more energy sloshing around on the Earth. So it does not mean a uniform rising of the temperature. It means droughts in one place. Simultaneously, we have flooding in another place. Simultaneously, forest fires someplace else. And that seems to be what we are having. Havoc with wacky weather, in part driven, we think, by global warming. But again, you can't point to any one thing and say, aha, that's global warming. Now, if you take a look at the big picture, you see something else. That is, you can actually calculate how much human activity has to do with this. We know how much energy comes to the planet Earth. It's a very easy calculation. We know how much sunlight is emitted from the Earth and how much sunlight falls on the Earth. We also know how much energy the Earth radiates into outer space. That's a very easy calculation. And then you simply subtract. Common sense says in equals out. The energy that we get from the sun equals the energy that we radiate into outer space. But if you do the calculation, you find there's a mismatch. A mismatch, meaning that the Earth is heating up. And if you include human activity, bingo, you find exactly where the mismatch is. So mathematically speaking, you can see that it's not just natural cycles that are driving this thing. It is basically human activity. Now, some people say, well, if global warming is that bad, then maybe, just maybe, the ace in the hole is nuclear energy. Nuclear energy uses the nuclear force. It does not use combustion of oxygen. And it's the combustion of oxygen through oxidation that causes global warming. The burning of oxygen creates carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. Light checks in, hits the Earth, but light energy does not check out, meaning that the Earth heats up. Well, some people say nuclear is the way to go. You can burn uranium without creating carbon dioxide, but not so fast. It turns out that Europe is turning its back on nuclear energy. Japan is saying that it's riddled with earthquake faults and perhaps it's unsuitable to have nuclear power plants there. In the United States, we'll ask Michael Marriott in a few minutes, what are we going to do with all the nuclear waste? We're just piling up with nuclear waste, and no repository for nuclear waste exists at the present time. President Barack Obama himself canceled the Yucca Mountains repository that was supposed to receive nuclear waste from the weapons laboratories and from commercial sites, and it will be closed, according to President Barack Obama. So what about the prospects of nuclear? Well, you would have to create thousands of nuclear power plants around the world in order to make a dent with nuclear warming. Because, you see, it's coal that drives a lot of global warming, as well as the burning of fossil fuels in transportation. In fact, transportation takes up about 50% of all the carbon dioxide being produced. And nuclear does not displace gasoline. You don't put uranium in your gas tank. Uranium displaces coal and therefore makes some dent on global warming. But gasoline is used in cars, which in turn drives 50% of global warming. And nuclear makes no dent at all in the gasoline being consumed. So in other words, you have to increase the number of nuclear power plants into the thousands before you make a dent on global warming. And that's simply not going to happen. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest today. He's Michael Marriott, director of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And we're going to talk about the future and past of nuclear energy. What really happened at Fukushima? How long will it take to clean up that mess? And what does it mean for nuclear energy in the United States? President Barack Obama, who recently got reelected, has stated that, yes, nuclear energy will be a part of America's nuclear future, if only because we have to combat the greenhouse effect. So does nuclear really combat the greenhouse effect? All these questions we're going to be asking Michael Marriott, head of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. Michael, tell us a little bit about NIRS. What is the Nuclear Information Resource Service?
Well, we're an organization about to celebrate our 35th anniversary. We were set up to be the information and networking center for what was then and remains today a very decentralized grassroots movement against nuclear power. And we're working to build a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future because it's what our planet needs and it's what our planet deserves.
And what is your website?
www.nirs.org, and we're actually kind of proud that the Library of Congress recently declared it a significant website, and they're archiving it from now on.
Oh, is that right? Okay, well, let's just jump right into things. It was over a year and a half ago that we had one of the worst nuclear accidents in memory, right up there with Chernobyl, and that, of course, is the Fukushima disaster. So, first of all, tell us exactly what happened in the opening days of the accident.
Well, you know, some of the details still aren't known and won't be known for some years, but you know, essentially there was an extremely large earthquake, about a 9.0 or so, followed by a very large tsunami. It appears that the earthquake caused some problems at some of the reactors, may have broken some cooling water pipes and that kind of thing. But that was those problems were soon dwarfed by the tsunami, which knocked out all of the reactors' emergency backup power systems in the reactors, six of them there actually, were left without power. Reactors need power to operate their safety systems. They rely on power that comes from off-site. Because of the nature of the earthquake and tsunami, there was no, all of the power lines and ability to transmit power to the site was destroyed. And without backup power, they were sitting there essentially helpless. They managed to hook up one generator to Fukushima units 5 and 6 that kept those barely protected. But for the other four, they weren't protected. The fuel overheated, melted. Hydrogen gas was created inside the rather small containment buildings of the of these particular reactor designs, which are General Electric Mark I. They're U.S.-designed reactors. The hydrogen exploded and at several of the reactors and created the images that we all saw back in March 2011 of these reactor buildings just exploding. Large quantities of radiation were released and into the air. And over the next several weeks, months, and continuing into the water around the area, and eventually this radiation went across the world, both in the air and in the water. Japan did receive, I don't want to call it good luck, but they were fortunate in that the wind pattern through most of the days of the highest releases was directly east over the Pacific Ocean rather than over land, so that it's been estimated that 80% of the airborne radiation went out over the ocean instead of over the land. This could have been a much, much worse scenario in terms of consequences to people had the wind been blowing slightly differently.
Okay, Mike, let me ask you a question.
That's not much to rely on as a safety measure.
Okay. Now, as I understand, the backup generators were located in the basement of the reactor, and the tsunami flooded the basement, wiping out all backup systems. Do you think that was a wise decision, knowing that Japan is riddled with earthquake faults, knowing there's a long history going back over 1,000 years of monster tsunamis swamping Japan? Do you think it was a good idea to put their generators in the basement?
Well, I think it was a bad idea to build the reactors there in the first place, regardless of the generators. I mean, there is, you know, there's been some theories that had the generators been, you know, put up higher, either inside the buildings or, you know, perhaps on the bluff overlooking the site, maybe the problems wouldn't have been so severe. As I noted, it, you know, the earthquake itself caused some damage, so it's not clear what would have happened. But you know, I think the real problem is building reactors on earthquake faults to begin with, and I think that's why we're seeing, you know, Japan in fits and starts, you know, reassessing its nuclear program and the whole concept of putting nuclear reactors in such a seismically active area.
Now, I understand that in the opening hours of the accident, the only correct decision was made by a worker who decided to go against orders, against direct orders from his superior, and he flooded the reactor with salt water, which, of course, destroyed the reactors, but prevented a full-scale catastrophe. Could you elaborate? Did we come
that
close?
You know, Tokyo Electric Power had a reputation as a pretty bad utility before Fukushima. They were the owners of the reactor, and it has come out since that, in fact, they did not take adequate protective measures before the earthquake and tsunami. They knew this was possible. They didn't do anything about it. And in the early days of the accident, you know, in fairness, things are pretty confusing and chaotic. But, yeah, in the early, as the accident began developing, it appears that, you know, some of the leadership of this utility were still more concerned about their reactors, and maybe they could restart them someday, than they were about the public nearby. And so, yeah, it did take some heroic efforts. I don't know if it was just one person or more than one, but it took some heroic efforts by plant workers to admit to themselves that, you know, these reactors were toast, and in any event, and they had to try to save the surrounding countryside.
Now, it has since come out that we now know that the utility and the government were talking about evacuating Tokyo. This, of course, would be the worst-case scenario, but it's something they were thinking about. And imagine, Tokyo is one of the most congested, heavily populated regions on the planet Earth. You would have to take out 20 million people. So do you think that's even feasible? Do you think that this is a nightmare scenario, that it's beyond comprehension?
Well, no, it's not feasible to evacuate a city like Tokyo, just like it's not feasible to evacuate a city like New York or Los Angeles or Chicago. I mean, it's just not not something that can be done without, you know, extreme chaos, loss of life, and difficulty. But, you know, if that wind pattern that I mentioned earlier, if that wind had been blowing toward Tokyo, that might have become that, you know, that nightmare scenario that they did look at, you know, might have become something they were going to have to consider. And, you know, really, in those early days, they were looking at the possibility of a Japan that would basically be cut in half, where you would have a southern Japan, you would have a no man's land in central Japan, and then a northern Japan. You know, that was a possibility that you know, could have happened. It didn't, fortunately, but it could have.
Now, during the accident, the utility was giving soothing words, basically saying that things are under control, things are stable. Now we realize that the core actually liquefied in one of these reactors, something that we've never seen before. We've never seen a 100% melt where the core simply turns into liquid. So what is the state of the core now? They're beginning to put TV cameras into the core. What is the state of the cores?
Well, as best we know, the core has, you know, re-solidified. The temperatures inside there are not high enough so that continued melting is going on. What we really don't know yet, and the cameras haven't been, you know, very helpful in finding out, is, you know, how far into the, there's a concrete base, what's called a concrete base mat underneath the reactors. We don't know how far that was penetrated. We don't know if, you know, some of this molten core at the time it got in, you know, sort of outside the reactor building area, you know, into actual earth, you know, into the ground, into potentially groundwater.
That's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest has been Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, giving us an update in light of President Barack Obama's reelection, in light of the double whammy that hit the Northeast, prompting many people to say that maybe nuclear energy is the cure for our ills concerning global warming. Well, what about the future of nuclear? Or for that matter, what about the past? What really happened at Fukushima? And what does it mean if the Europeans begin to turn their back to nuclear energy? All these questions we will continue to ask Michael Marriott of NIRS when we continue with the next part of Exploration. Michael, where we last left off, we were talking about the nuclear fuel at Fukushima, some of which completely liquefied and melted, something which has never happened before at a commercial nuclear power plant. But now, well, temperatures are below the melting point. And so the question is, what happens next?
Fuel, this molten fuel, is going to be radioactive for hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years, and, you know, very highly radioactive for quite a long time. Just because it stopped melting doesn't mean that it's not, you know, extraordinarily radioactive and, you know, lethal, as you say. But, you know, what it does indicate, of course, is, you know, what we do know is that the fuel did get out of the reactor vessels and, you know, out of the containment. And I hate to even use the word cleanup, but, this is going to be a job that is very long, very slow, and very dangerous for decades.
Now, the latest indicators show that 40 years is what's projected by the utility to finish the cleanup, after which they're going to entomb the whole facility, just like at Chernobyl. But speaking about Chernobyl, it's been 25 years since that accident. That accident hasn't stopped either, right? Isn't the core still slowly melting, even at Chernobyl?
No, I don't think the core is melting at Chernobyl. I mean, the radiation, you know, from these kinds of accidents, you know, continues indefinitely. You're talking about radioisotopes that have been released that have, you know, half-lives in the decades to centuries to millennia, and that radiation, you know, it's still coming out. But, you know, I think, you know, particularly for Fukushima, the problem, the biggest problem that's being faced right now is that, you know, as you say, we're looking at a, you know, probable 40-year cleanup period in an area that already has been struck by one giant earthquake and is seismically very active. Just this morning, I was reading that there were, four different moderate-sized earthquakes, you know, around 5.0 or so, this morning in that area. And you have buildings there that have suffered extreme damage, and, you know, regardless of how they made it through the first earthquake, they're probably not as structurally sound as they were, in February 2011. So they're probably not going to be able to withstand another, you know, significant earthquake, and yet they're in that zone, and they've got to clean this place up before that next earthquake happens. And that's, you know, it's a race against time in some ways, but it's also a very slow process.
Now, recently, headlines were made in Tokyo when a professor at Tokyo University, a seismologist, commenting on the frequency of small earthquakes, which is quite high now, predicted this is a 70% chance of a major earthquake hitting Tokyo now, not Fukushima, but Tokyo, within the next 10 years. That's potentially catastrophic. And given the fact that Japan is a small island, given the fact that it has lots of nuclear power plants, don't you think that could be a prescription for disaster if now Tokyo is hit with a large earthquake, destabilizing the reactors in that area?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, a large earthquake in Tokyo is going to be catastrophic with or without the nuclear reactors. But I think that, you know, the main point really is that, you know, there are no reactors in Japan that are immune from earthquake damage. The two reactors they restarted this past summer at, I think it's pronounced Oi, they've been investigating, and it looks like those are right over some active earthquake faults and may have to be shut down again. And, you know, in that area of the world, which, you know, is so seismically active, you know, there's really no place in Japan where nuclear reactors are immune from the threat of earthquakes.
Okay.
I mean, they're all dangerous, and that's why you're seeing, you know, certainly the Japanese public overwhelmingly against resumption of operations of any nuclear reactors.
Now, moving to the United States, it's been many a decade since the last nuclear power plant was licensed. You have to go back before Three Mile Island, the 1979 accident, to find when reactors were licensed. But now the Obama administration is pushing the deployment of nuclear power plants, and given the fact that he was reelected, meaning that he has four more years, what do you predict is going to happen with the licensing of new nuclear power plants?
Well, a couple of things. You know, the push for new reactors really began under the Bush administration. The first applications that were filed in, you know, 30-some years came in 2007 and 2008. And so, you know, that's in the Energy Bill of 2005 is what set up the some of the financial incentives for utilities to build new reactors. And back then, late 2008, early 2009, there were something like applications or what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission called pending applications expected for about 32 new reactors in this country. What we've gotten since that time is approval of two reactor complexes, totaling four reactors, two in Georgia, two in South Carolina. Those are under construction. There was the resumption of a reactor that had been where construction had actually stopped for more than two decades in Tennessee, a reactor being built by Tennessee Valley Authority. And right now, that's pretty much it. The much vaunted nuclear renaissance right now consists of five reactors that, you know, may or may not get built. The problems down in Georgia in particular have been significant. Just, you know, earlier this week, there was the utilities that are that would be operating the plant, that the plant would be licensed to, were hit with a $900 million lawsuit by the contractors who are building the plant. And so we're already seeing, you know, sort of a repeat of what happened in the late 1970s and 1980s, where, you know, construction is not going well, cost overruns are expected, and delays are expected. And so, you know, we just don't know. You know, our bet is that these guys can't build a reactor on time and on budget. And if these reactors, you know, prove that out, you know, we're not going to see anymore because the economics of it is already pretty bad. The Obama administration, I mean, the main thing that they have done to support new nuclear power was give a conditional loan guarantee of about $8.3 billion for this project in Georgia. And now, what's interesting about that is that this was announced in February 2010, and President Obama himself announced it at a press event in Maryland. And that loan guarantee still has not been given. And in fact, it is not clear that it's ever actually going to go out the door. The Department of Energy, by virtue of a 2007 legislation, has $18.5 billion in loan guarantee money that they can dole out for construction of new reactors. That Georgia project, that $8 billion one, is the only one that has gone out the door. They haven't been able to give away any of the other money. And even this Georgia money is suspect now. The White House Office of Management and Budget is pretty leery about the whole concept. They think it's risky. And so they're, you know, trying to put conditions on it that Georgia Power, which would be the lead recipient, doesn't seem to want to meet. I mean, the utilities just basically want free money. So, you know, they don't want to be putting up their own money to get a loan. You know, they don't want to make the kind of down payment you or I would have to make on a house, for example, if we were trying to get a loan for a mortgage. They don't want to do that. They're looking for free money, and so it's not clear they're going to get it.
Okay, Michael, let me ask you a question about how safe this new generation of nuclear power plants are. Some people call them, quote, inherently safe. That is, they use natural mechanisms. For example, gravity. Everyone knows gravity falls down, not up. So it uses these things to take advantage of the fact that you don't need so many pumps and you don't need so many levers and gears that could fail. All you have to do is use the natural force of gravity. So what are your thoughts about inherently safe nuclear power plants?
Well, you know, there's no such thing as an inherently safe nuclear reactor. Nuclear power is inherently dangerous technology, and it's not possible to take something that is inherently dangerous and somehow render it inherently safe. Yeah, there's no question that the new designs are better than the old designs. That's to be expected. If you go out and buy a 2012 Chevy Volt, it's probably a safer car than your grandfather's 1972 Chevy Impala. Doesn't mean you can't be in a car accident. Doesn't mean that you're perfectly safe. And that's sort of the analogy I use is, yeah, of course there's been improvements that, we're looking, 40, 50 years since those first reactors were designed. But they're not fail-safe. They are vulnerable to, in some cases, some different types of accidents. But it's just not possible to make them inherently safe.
Now, for a while, there was talk about going to a radically new reactor design using gas-cooled reactors instead of water-cooled reactors, using cores made out of pebbles rather than long rods. What are your thoughts about whether this new generation is nothing but old wine in new bottles?
Well, gas-cooled reactor, sometimes it was called a pebble bed reactor at times. That just hasn't taken off at all. I mean, there's no utilities that are interested in it. And you keep seeing references to it. It actually also has some safety flaws to it. I won't go into them right now, but it does have some drawbacks to it. But the reality is the utilities don't want to build it anyway, so it's sort of off the radar at the moment. What we're left with are what the utilities are building in Georgia and South Carolina, what's called a Westinghouse AP1000 design. It's a pressurized water reactor. More than half of the reactors currently operating in the U.S. are pressurized water reactors. I mean, these are just, I think the new car analogy works pretty well. These are updates of the old design. They're not radically different, and they're not inherently safe.
And speaking about the technology, what are we going to do with the nuclear waste? The nuclear waste was supposed to be placed in the Yucca Mountains outside Las Vegas. However, President Barack Obama, probably for political reasons, we don't know for sure, but he canceled the Yucca Mountains site. So right now we have basically nuclear constipation, all this nuclear waste backing up at nuclear sites. So what's the status of nuclear waste disposal?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's something that we think is going to get a lot of attention, something that we're going to be working on a lot over the next 2 years. We're getting prepared for another major legislative battle on nuclear waste. It's really the first one in a generation. You're right that President Obama canceled the Yucca Mountain project. We think it's one of the best things he's done since he came to office. And so, the issue becomes, what are we going to do? And the Secretary of Energy had set up a Blue Ribbon Commission that met for 2 years to discuss the waste issue. Came out with a report last year. The White House was slated to come out with some legislative proposals based on the commission's findings earlier this year. They did not do that. And there was one bill introduced in the Senate by the Senate Energy Committee Chairman Jeff Bingaman, who is retiring at the end of this session. So it didn't go anywhere. So what we're going to be looking at is what the industry wants is interim storage. They've pretty much given up on the idea that we're going to find a permanent site for waste anytime soon. So what they want is called consolidated interim storage, meaning that you'd find essentially a parking lot somewhere. You'd fill up waste casks, you'd send them across the country to this parking lot, and you'd store it all at this one site or maybe two or three sites around the country until somebody comes up with a better idea. And the Blue Ribbon Commission did endorse this idea. We're not sure the White House is going to endorse it, but the Blue Ribbon Commission did. We are unalterably opposed to this concept. because it doesn't solve the problem, and it puts radioactive waste on the highways and railways. And, of course, the one thing certain about radioactive waste is that it's more dangerous when it's moving at 50 or 60 miles an hour than when it's standing still. So to us, that's not a solution. The other things the commission recommended are of somewhat more interest. Without endorsing them, they are talking about maybe taking the entire waste program out of the Department of Energy and setting up some new independent body to oversee it. They're talking about finding and setting up some mechanism to obtain community consent for a radioactive waste site, which is a new concept, I guess. How that would manifest itself, we're not clear, but we certainly think that any potential permanent waste site should have the consent of the community. And some other changes like that, sort of more structural type changes in, how we're going to look for a new site rather than trying to, the Blue Ribbon Commission did not try to, for example, pick a new site. They didn't do that kind of scientific work to determine what might be a good site. They were looking more at the structural issues as to how we're going to go about looking for a site to replace Yucca Mountain. And in that sense, it probably made sense, but that also makes clear that, we're not going to have a permanent site for a good long time. We have to first find a site, then we have to characterize it, make sure it actually will work as a potential site. We have to get community consent. These are all steps that are going to take a long time. So in the interim, what the environmental community has rallied around and has the endorsement of basically every national environmental group that works on nuclear power issues, just about every regional and large local group that works on nuclear power issues, is something called HOSS, H-O-S-S. And what that means is hardened on-site storage. And this is not a permanent solution, but it is the interim solution, which is you leave it where the waste was generated. You don't try to transport it anywhere. You put it in dry casks, and then you harden these casks.
And then you cross your fingers, right?
Well, you harden them. You put it in under berms, or try to set it up so that they are less likely to be terrorist targets, that they can better withstand natural disasters. And by the way, at Fukushima, the only facility at Fukushima that withstood both the earthquake and the tsunami was the waste that they had in dry casks, because they had put some of their waste in these dry casks, and they were sort of set off from the other facilities there, and they withstood both the earthquake and tsunami.
Now, Michael, you mentioned terrorism, right? Do you feel confident that these open casks sitting in a parking lot someplace would be able to withstand hardened terrorists intent on blowing these casks up and then spewing nuclear waste over people's backyards, creating panic?
No, I don't feel confident about that at all. Particularly if you have the centralized storage concept I was talking about that the industry is looking for, where they would basically just be stacking these casks up. You would have an enormous inventory of radiation in this high-level waste. I mean, you have to remember that 95% of all the radioactivity ever created in the United States of America from all processes, including weapons development and power generation, 90% of that radioactivity is contained in this radioactive waste, in this high-level fuel from these commercial nuclear reactors. So, it's just an enormous inventory of radiation, and consolidating it, especially above ground, it would be a terrible idea.
And some
leaving
people,
it on site, leaving it on site unprotected is not a good idea either.
And some people are opposed to shipping it through people's backyard. They call it mobile Chernobyl. So do you feel confident that we have the capability of shipping high-level nuclear waste right through people's backyards?
Absolutely not. In fact, NIRS was the group that came up with the tagline, Mobile Chernobyl, 15, 20 years ago now, when this idea first came up during the Clinton administration. And back then, what the industry wanted was because they thought the pace of work at Yucca Mountain was too slow. They wanted to just go ahead and start shipping at the Yucca Mountain anyway and just leave it outside until the dump was finished. We fought that successfully. We got President Clinton to veto a bill that actually had passed the Senate, or had passed the Congress, to establish that site. President Clinton vetoed the bill, and the veto was upheld by the Senate by one vote. This concept of that the utilities now want of consolidated interim storage is really just the same thing, repackaged. Of course, now we also have the added slogan of Fukushima freeways, and we're going to work just as hard to stop it this time around as we did last time.
And looking at the big picture now, some people point to Hurricane Sandy and global warming, perhaps, that could accelerate, and then they see nuclear power as a white knight, because nuclear power does not release carbon dioxide. So some people think that, therefore, nuclear power should be considered part of the energy mix, because there's even a worse threat, and that is doomsday scenarios involving global warming. What are your thoughts?
Nuclear power is the least effective means of addressing the climate crisis that we have available. Nuclear power does not work well in a warming world. We already saw that this past summer. Reactors have to shut down because the water had become too warm for their systems, including the Millstone reactor on Long Island Sound. And, you know, let me tell you, the Long Island Sound, when water there gets too warm for a nuclear reactor, we're already having some serious problems. But a nuclear reactor doesn't do you any good if it's closed. And that's what happened in various parts of this country this past summer, and it's happened in other countries, notably France, earlier in this decade, where the water was just too hot, the reactors couldn't use it. So it doesn't work well in a warming world. But the second thing is that nuclear power is the most expensive climate solution possible. Nuclear reactors cost extraordinary amounts of money to build, and solar and wind power in particular have been dropping in costs, especially over this past decade, so that in a lot of states already new solar power is cheaper than new nuclear power. Wind power has been competitive with nuclear power for a decade or more already. And continues, and even offshore wind now, which is a little more expensive but also works better, is now competitive with nuclear power. And when you have limited resources, as our nation has, as all nations have, you have to use them wisely. So in terms of bang for the buck, energy efficiency is the lowest hanging fruit, continuing to make our buildings more efficient, continuing to make our appliances and other electronic things more efficient. That's what gives you the most bang for the buck. And then smart building design, that kind of thing. And then after that, the renewables are going to be the key. The one other thing I'll say about going nuclear is that you would have to build so many new reactors that it's just not even feasible. And yeah, we were just talking about the radioactive waste problem from the reactors we already have, the 120 reactors that have operated at one time or another in the United States. Well, you know, just for nuclear to play a significant role in reducing carbon emissions, just in the United States, we'd have to triple the amount of reactors we have. Now, that means you've got triple the radioactive waste problem. You've got triple the threat of accidents. And that's just for the United States. You know, globally, it's even worse. It's just, it's not a solution that makes any sense.
Okay, one last question about the worldwide prospects for nuclear. Germany has thrown in the towel and said no more nukes. Switzerland followed suit. However, China is still going full blast, building every sort of power plant it can get its hands on. So what are your thoughts about the international situation?
Well, you're right. It's a little bit mixed. Europe is moving away from nuclear power. Italy, by the way, also, you know, is a no-nuclear country. Austria has been for a long time. Denmark, Ireland. The UK is talking about building new reactors, but they don't want to give the reactor, they don't want to give the utilities any government subsidies to do so. So the utilities are balking.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. So, Michael, thank you so much for being on Exploration. Once again, our special guest has been Michael Marriott of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, talking to us about the past, the present, and the future of nuclear energy. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.